From KALW News in San Francisco, this is a special edition of Cross Currents, context, culture, and canines from around the Bay Area.
I'm in the Western Edition.
Haight Ashbury. I live in the Nastro.
Corona Heights.
Dogs outnumber kids in San Francisco. So today, we'll see how the city handles the ebb and flow of dog ownership.
Here, he'll find a really good home and he'll get taken care of until that happens, huh, buddy? Yeah.
Then we'll explore the industry around our canine population.
I wouldn't hesitate to spend any amount of money to make sure that my dogs are well cared for.
And we'll hear from those who think it's gone too far.
I don't think you should have dogs in restaurants. Or just lots of people who are in a confined space who might not like your dog.
That and more today on our Dog Show edition of Cross Currents.
Dog Show!
Dogs.
Dogs!
The first thing that stands out about dogs, or at least in San Francisco, is their sheer number.
About 120,000 of them live among us. That's one dog for every 7 San Francisco residents.
And yes, that is more dogs than children, and it's up about 20% from just 8 years ago.
It's also not just a San Francisco thing. 2010 census data shows that there are now more households with dogs than children across the country.
And the effects of this are rippling through our society. There's now a booming economy around dogs.
Dogs now have access to a lot of the same things people do.
There's psychologists for your dog.
Doggy ambulances. Special courtrooms for criminal dogs.
Dog blood banks.
Wait, seriously?
Oh yeah.
That's just weird.
By the way, I had a dog growing up, so I totally don't mind dogs.
And I totally am obsessed with them.
But whether or not the rest of you love dogs, they're a big part of life in San Francisco.
So what does this say about where we live? And about us? That's what we're exploring today.
And remember, anything's possible.
Oh, we're gonna try to keep the dog puns to a minimum. So to start off, we're going to take you to one place in San Francisco where dog ownership, industry, and controversy all intersect.
And it happens on one weekend once a year.
Oh my God, it's so cute! Oh my God, I'm having a heart attack!
The Golden Gate Kennel Club Dog Show.
Okay, come on, we'll go this way. This is the quieter side. My name is Dorothy Bobbitt, known as Jean.
Chris and I went to the dog show at the Cow Palace in San Francisco last year. Jean Bobbitt is one of the first people we met there.
Bobbitt is a dog show legend, so we asked her to explain how it works.
These dogs are judged by the breed from the puppies 6 months of age and older through the older dogs, and the dogs are separate from the bitches.
Is that a technical term?
Bitches are what female dogs are called. It's not a dirty word anymore. It's bitches. That's what we call. My mother had a fit when she heard me say that the first time. She wanted to wash my mouth out with soap.
Bitches aside, as we talked with Bobbitt, it became clear. The dog show's main business is breeding.
The competition is about seeing which dog best represents its breed, down to the size of its tail, head, and testicles. Seriously.
And besides the competition, there's also what's called a benched show, which means
the person sits with their dog there on the bench, and the dog has to be visible because we have a paying public that comes in, and this paying public is invited to talk to the people who have their dogs on the bench.
Oh, these are the benches. We've got Davisher Great Danes, Sherricks Bloodhounds, Boxers, Portuguese Water Dogs.
Over 2,000 dogs representing 100 breeds were at the show that weekend. And if you wanted to pet one or get to know more about a particular breed, this was just the place to do it.
And if you fell in love, you could go home with one.
Well, for a price.
We're somewhere between $800 and $1,200 a puppy. And your Portuguese Water Dogs, I think, are going for about $2,500.
And for a Wolfhound, ours are generally $2,000 for a puppy.
I breed water dogs now, and they can range in price from $1,800 to $3,500.
Obviously, not everybody can afford to pay thousands of dollars to buy a dog, not even in a city like San Francisco.
But there are alternatives to buying from a breeder, In the Bay Area, there are dozens of shelters where you can get a dog, including the city's Animal Control Center.
We asked reporter Alyssa Kapnick to see what it takes to manage the fancies of a dog-loving city.
The pound, the shelter, animal control, whatever you call it, pop culture America has decided it's a horrible place.
Think they belong to anyone? If they did, would they be here? Better here than the pound.
And when I heard they'd taken you to the pound...
Oh, don't even mention that horrible place. I was so embarrassed and frightened.
Oh, no.
But just walk inside the San Francisco SPCA and you'll see a completely different kind of shelter. The building has lofted ceilings and tall windows.
We have what we like to call condos instead of the typical cages that you'll find in a lot of shelters.
Krista Maloney is the SPCA's media associate. If you're adopting a dog in the city, chances are you'll end up here.
Kind of think of it as a walk-in closet with a panel of glass on the front.
The condos vary in size, but they're mostly about 10 by 15 feet. Each dog has its own little cot, blankets, toys, and a roommate. The shelter puts them together for company when possible.
As you can see, it's really, really nice in the evening time. The sunlight comes directly in, and he looks pretty happy there.
Yeah, he does. SPCA stands for Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Its mission is to take the dogs that need the most help. The dogs who've not only been abandoned, but who are also sick or anxious. Dogs like Basil.
Hello, dear.
Basil is a miniature pincher, a small black dog with brown eyebrows. Donna Brown lives in the Western Addition neighborhood of San Francisco, and she's looking to adopt Basil.
I'm no longer working right now, so sometimes I get lonely. So I think it would have been a good, you know, to have a good companion.
Animals are the best medicine. So. Which collar would you like?
Brown seems to really like Basil. But before she can take him home, she's got to listen to the adoption agent, Ashley James, explain just about every detail of dog ownership, from dealing with fleas to poop routines to health insurance plans. The SPCA makes it a priority to place dogs with the right owners. They'd rather take a dog back than consign it to the wrong home. So before they go, Ashley James tells Brown that if she ends up changing her mind about Basil, she can always return him. No questions asked.
Did you say bye, everybody? Huh?
And with that, the two leave together to start their new life. Dogs that end up at the SPCA have a good shot at finding new homes. The agency adopts out about 2,000 dogs each year. Most are in the shelter for just a few weeks. That success rate is partly because, in the last few years, the SPCA has received, on average, $23 million in donations, grants, and fees for services. They have a lot of resources to devote to their dogs. To be part of that success, though, the dogs have to get into the SPCA, and that part's more complicated. See, unless you got it from them in the first place, you actually can't bring your unwanted dog to the SPCA. Instead, you have to go across the street to Animal Care and Control, ACC.
So we're going to start with a tour here on the second floor.
When I arrive, ACC spokesperson Deb Campbell leads me down a dimly lit hallway. If the SPCA is the Hotel Ritz, ACC is a Motel 6. Slightly run down, fluorescent lights.
Well, we're an older building. We were built back, I think, in the 30s. This used to be a supply building. So everything's a little antiquated, and it's not quite set up as a shelter should be, but we do the best with what we've got.
It's not surprising to find such stark differences between ACC and the SPCA. Remember that $23 million a year the SPCA gets in grants and private donations? ACC is a government agency and runs on just a fraction of that, just over $4 million a year.
With staff salaries and benefits and things like that, it doesn't leave a lot for animal care.
Over the past few years, that $4 million has had to go further as more and more animals come to ACC's doors.
We have fish, we have rabbits, we have chicken, we have guinea pigs, we have hamsters, dogs, cats, goats.
This is Kristen Hall, who's worked with ACC for the past few years.
We have an obligation to take any animal that comes through the door, no matter what kind of animal it is and no matter what condition it's in.
They even take wounded pigeons and lost ducklings. Overall, ACC takes in 10,000 animals a year of all kinds. And Hall says they don't put animals down unless they're violent or untreatably ill. They end up putting down about 16% of dogs that come through the shelter. And the ACC says they work hard to keep that number low. They do everything they can for the animals that end up staying.
We don't have a time frame. The animals, as long as they're adoptable, can stay here forever. Our longest-term resident is Harry the Rabbit. He's been here since July of 2011.
ACC works with a network of other shelters around the Bay Area to try to get animals into better situations. The SPCA gets a lot of its dogs here. They cross the street regularly to take the most difficult-to-place animals, rehabilitate them, and adopt them out. There are also more specialized shelters.
Muttville for senior dogs, Rocket Dog Rescue, Cats Give Me Shelter, 10th Life, Feral Fix, the Sonoma Reptile Rescue, Peninsula Humane Society, PHS. There's a lot of other rescue groups.
But in the meantime, those pets wait here, and they don't live in condos. The dogs, for example, usually get only one or two walks a day. They spend the other 23 hours in their cages. It's all the agency's able to do, which isn't to say the staff doesn't care about the animals. Hall takes me to meet one of her current favorite dogs, a dachshund mix with silky black fur named Baptiste.
Oh, it's a good boy. Oh, it's a good boy.
Yeah. Oh, hi, handsome. Hi, handsome.
He looks like he's smiling from ear to ear, and his whole body wiggles when he wags his tail.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for the loving.
Baptiste has already been here for a few weeks, but Hall seems hopeful he'll find a family. Just like at the SPCA, the idea that these dogs go to the right home is almost a superstition among ACC staff.
Oh, yeah, this one day there was a dog that was supposed to go on a field trip event, and he was just a really nice, easygoing dog. And the day of the event, they were getting him ready, putting his harness on and everything to take him on the event, and he got really agitated in a way that he didn't normally behave. And so they decided not to take him on the event. And right after that, a family came in that had come specifically for him. I'm going to start crying. He wouldn't have been here. So it's like he knew. He's like, no, my people are coming.
San Francisco's shelter system is not nearly as grim as people imagine. For many of these animals, going to the pound isn't a punishment or a death sentence. It's a chance to find a home. For Cross Currents, I'm Alyssa Kapnick.
That story was reported in September of 2013.
Man, this is definitely the dark side of having so many people owning dogs. I guess you can't avoid more of them being abandoned.
Yeah, totally. And the responsibility for those animals then falls to the city, you know, to us.
Well, that's true. But there is an upside, at least for the city. The more people getting dogs, the more money being spent on them. Listening to a special dog show edition of Cross Currents. I'm Martina Castro.
And I'm Chris Hoff. Let's go back now to the Golden Gate Kennel Club dog show to hear more from dog show legend Jean Bobbitt. She knows a thing or two about the economy around dogs.
Bay F, Ring 23.
Did you grow up with dogs?
Uh-huh.
Where did you grow up?
Here in San Francisco, native born, yeah. My early pictures show a fox terrier. Or as my folks said, it was a fox terrible.
Jean Bobbitt is in her 90s, and she's been in the dog business for six decades. She started off as a trainer, something she does to this day, by the way.
And over the years, she became a breeder, a handler, and even an entrepreneur.
I went into dog beds and dog equipment, and I still make crate pads and cuddle blankets.
And you could find all that and more for sale there. A whole wing of the Cow Palace was filled with vendors.
We are the dog sports booth. We carry lots of leather, canine equipment, collars and leashes, harnesses.
We sell pet furniture for dogs and cats.
We're basically selling synthetic lawns for pet owners.
My collars range from $17 to $23 for the normal collars.
The big seller has been these collars that have the flashing lights.
I do have a specialized collar with the prongs, which is up to $40.
It was like a snapshot of what's happening in storefronts all across San Francisco.
There are actually no hard numbers on how big the dog economy is in the city. And as far as we can tell, no one's keeping track.
But what we do know is that investors are starting to take note. We asked reporter Casey Miner to take us on a tour of San Francisco's dog economy. She started in a neighborhood with one of the highest concentrations of dog businesses in the city, the Marina.
Let's say you wanted to take your dog out on Union Street one day after work. Let's call your dog Fluffy. So first, you pick Fluffy up where you left her that morning.
The Moulin Pooch Doggy Daycare.
Moulin Pooch calls itself a dog boutique and villa. Fancy. It would be nice to stick around for yappy hour, but she's been there all day. So how about a change of scenery?
This is a pet grooming headquarters.
In this tiny shop, just a few blocks away, Fluffy can get a bath, a haircut, and a nail trim. Then, all fluffed up, it's time for a treat.
This is Limercel Dog Bakery. So it's a full-scale bakery for dogs. There's around like 60 different treats for dogs. They're all made on location by our pastry chef.
Oh, and actually, I forgot to mention this. Today is Fluffy's special day.
Of course, birthday cakes come in like 4 different sizes, 2 different flavors.
And finally, after an afternoon of pampering, it's time for a well-deserved trip to the dog park just around the corner. This is just one street, one tiny slice of the dog services the Bay Area has to offer. There's a dogumentary photographer and an animal communicator. There are dog Reiki practitioners and dog massage therapists. There's a newspaper called Bay Woof, a pet taxi, and a raw pet food delivery service. There are at least 300 members of the San Francisco Professional Dog Walkers Association. And while we don't know the total size of San Francisco's dog economy, we do know what prices these services can fetch. Fluffy's day out, which really uses just a few of the services, would cost about $120. And many new business owners are finding that there's seemingly endless demand.
So we have Bailey, we have snacks. Let's see, who else is in there? The retriever over there is Cooper A, because we have a Cooper P. We tend to keep a really close eye on him because he's a poop eater.
Anna Gill knows the name and temperament of every one of the dogs who frequent her business, between 80 and 100 of them most weekdays. It's a doggy daycare called Dogpile Dogs on a 22,000-square-foot lot behind a fence in the aptly chosen Dog Patch neighborhood. The dogs spend most of their time hanging out in big outdoor yards.
It's a lovely space. It's a little bit like working on a farm in the middle of the city.
Just a few years ago, Gill was a corporate attorney, and she needed somewhere to bring her basset hound, Truman, while she was working.
I realized there are things that I wanted in the daycare services, so I started thinking about that over time. And I started setting it up in my mind, what I wanted for Truman. I retired from the practice of law from Genentech to open this place, and my life savings essentially is into this place. So I'm very grateful and thankful that it has worked out.
That was in 2009. Today, she's got 15 employees, and she says she gets 50 to 75 applicants within 2 days of posting a job. She doesn't advertise, but has attracted so much business that for a while she had to stop accepting new dogs just to keep the numbers manageable. And she's earned enough money to start expanding.
We're about to open up the south end there and create a little senior oasis for some of the older dogs. It'll be really nice. They'll have a nice sun deck for them to lay out on. There'll be lots of trees and plants. And we'll just try that out, see how that works.
Gill says details like this matter to her clients.
We have people bringing in dogs who are medications, for example, for Prozac if they're anxious. The collars and jackets that are on these dogs are all just the best. They're designer labels. They're Gucci and just any high-end designer that you could think of. We have dogs coming in with very nice cashmere turtleneck sweaters with pearl buttons on them.
All this investment in dogs' health and happiness has also opened a new market, the dog-focused tech startup.
So I'm Ben Jacobs, CEO and co-founder of Whistle. And Whistle is the first company focused on using technology to keep pets healthy.
Whistle is a dog activity tracker, a little device you can attach to your dog's collar that records how much she's moving around each day.
And what this device does, it's waterproof, it's ruggedized, it just goes wherever your dog goes. It's constantly measuring your dog's activity with a very sensitive accelerometer. And then Whistle's job is to take all of that raw data, ultimately millions of data points per dog, and translate it into the way you already think about your animal.
In other words, to help dog owners and vets keep better track of what's normal, so they'll know when something's wrong.
So this is my dog, this is Duke. First thing you see is his total minutes of activity.
The app looks like a Facebook or Instagram feed, with entries saying how much your dog walked, photos you can share with friends, and warnings when you're going off track. Jacob says this reflects what they learned from surveying 3,000 potential customers around the country.
To anyone who has a dog, is the number one concern for any owner is their animal's wellness and their happiness. You know, it's phrased in terms of the dog's not only health, but also emotion.
And our emotions influence how we use our wallets. For dogs, at least, money might be able to buy happiness. Whistle's got $6 million in startup capital, 24 investors and advisors, and around 20 employees, and they just launched. They're among the first companies to the dog startup market, but not the only ones. AngelList, an online marketplace that connects startups with investors, lists 57 dog-focused tech companies around the country. Half of them joined just this year. In San Francisco, I'm Casey Miner for Cross Currents.
Casey reported that story in September of 2013. Listening to a special edition of Cross Currents, otherwise known as The Dog Show. I'm Martina Castro.
And I'm Chris Hoff. So that is pretty amazing. I knew people were into grooming their dogs and buying clothes for them, but designer labels and cashmere? Bakeries that cater only to dogs?
Yeah, but like the business owners were saying in that last story, people now care about their dogs in a different way. They want them to be happy.
But why? Like, why do so many of us want a dog in the first place?
Well, that question kind of came up at the Golden Gate Kennel Club Dog Show. Hey, Summit. Hi. Hi. You are like a big stuffed animal, a really big stuffed animal, like a bear. Yeah, and you slobber a lot. On the judging floor, I met a big Newfoundland named Summit and his owner, 18-year-old Emma Taylor.
All right, well, good luck, Summit.
I asked her about something that kept coming up at the dog show, which is the controversy around breeding dogs to such specific standards.
Are there any breeds that there's sort of things that encouraged in the breed that end up being not very good for the breed?
Yeah, like size, particularly for Newfoundlands. If there's an overly big dog, then there's more cases of torn ACLs. So it's important to focus on the big picture and not just one thing that's in style now.
But some people do.
Oh, yeah, a lot of people do. It's bad.
Breeding to such extremes, puppy mills, these are some of the negative things about dog shows and dog breeding that make the headlines. And those are very real problems that remind us this is an industry. But Emma Taylor says being part of the dog show world is good for her and her dog.
We love our dogs so much. We wouldn't do this if it wasn't fun.
And the other breeders and owners that we met at the dog show, all of them said that they think of their dogs as part of their family.
Once that animal is part of your family, that's exactly what it means. It is part of your family.
We know they're not people. They're not the same as our children, but they are part of our family, and we've assumed responsibility for them the day we said, okay, you can come live here.
All the breeders that you meet up here, their dog, if they're not members of their family, that's what they should be telling you first. Then there's something wrong. Then you're talking to a puppy mill, you know?
Kids used to say that to you. You love the dogs more than you love us. No, I loved them all, and the dogs, though, in a sense, are our children, too.
I spoke to Amy Cook about this very thing. She's a researcher in dog cognition in the psychology department of UC Berkeley, and she's also been a dog trainer for 20 years. I was specifically interested to learn more about the dog-human relationship and how that compares to the human-human relationship.
There's a
draw in us to have animals with us, to have animals that we can relate to. And I think that's probably the genesis of some of that draw. But then you have your close reasons of like, I don't have kids, I want something to nurture, or, you know, I always had a dog as a kid and I just love how loyal they are. We make these big romantic stories around what dogs do for us and what they're like. And I think those stories say more about what we want and what we're sort of like than they do about the actual relationship we have with dogs. We want them to be so much more romantic than they actually turn out to be. But I think the story, in a more academic way, is more about this co-story that we've had of dependency, where we've needed them, we've used them to get where we are today, to be the humans that we are today. They helped us out in the encampments we first settled. I mean, they were useful to us. And
but that's not the case now. I mean, so if we could sort of think of this, you know, I'm not a hunter anymore, or they're not at the campfire.
Right.
So what is going on from a psychological point of view in this relationship?
Yeah. You know, I see it positively and negatively. I think sometimes they do great things for us or psychologically. I mean, there's plenty of research about how the health benefits that having a dog, you know, confers.
And, like what?
We're more tactile with animals than we are. Certainly American society, I know this is not a universal, a worldwide thing. We all have very different touch rates country to country. But Americans don't touch each other very much. We're one of the lowest, we have the lowest touch rate. I think we're near with the Brits, I think, down to like zero or one per interaction, you know, per right. entire coffee time. Whereas, you know, if you're somewhere else, it's up in the hundreds. You know, I'm forgetting which countries, but that's very necessary for humans. Need to do that. Humans need to touch. It's our culture that's made us not do it much. But the oxytocin benefits you get, both yourself and that the dog also gets, are you know, are very they're great. They're impactful to us. Also, I know about there's research sort of on social support. If I don't have friends to turn to, I actually can turn to a dog. And I may not be able to arrange whether I have a friend. Everybody's life is a little different. You can't just decide, hey, Chris, I want to be your friend. Let's hang out for sure. But I can adopt a dog or I can get a cat.
I mean, so this idea, right, like if you were to move cities and you go somewhere and you have no sort of social network yet, but don't, I mean, let's just face it, it's more difficult to foster relationships between human beings. And so, like, to what degree do you find that people will use the dog as a substitute?
I think we do. I think that's a fair thing to say. And I'm on the fence about what I think, if that's a good or a bad thing. I think it's, of course, the story is more complicated and it's probably a good and a bad thing. I think people use them as substitute children plenty of times, something to nurture. I think people use them as substitute friends and substitute partners. You get to an age, you're divorced, and how many, you know, I know plenty of people who have a lot of animals kind of in place of that. And I suppose if you ask them, it wouldn't necessarily be the answer you'd get, that it's like, oh, no, I decided to turn away from people and I'm just going to invest in my pets. I don't think it's how we see it or want to see it. It's not flattering. But, you know, we are inherently social and we need these kinds of bonds with other beings of some sort. We need this to survive and to be mentally healthy.
I see. I mean, what do you, you know, people often use this term, you know, that a dog or a pet will give you unconditional love. What do you make of it? I mean, clearly that doesn't, in the human world, that's almost, I would say almost impossible. Well, that's a different topic, but
right.
what do you make of this idea of a dog providing unconditional love?
Yeah, again, my feeling is that that's a bit of a construct, right, that we just want to be true. I think what we're seeing, though, that we're wanting to label unconditional is this just abject joy. You've come home, and they're so glad that you did. And they're so excited to see you, and it's so awesome to be with you, even if we're doing nothing. And I don't know that I have a single other person in my life that just feels that way every single time I come home or want to do something fun or whatever. That isn't there. So that feels a little like that unconditional thing. Like, I've had a bad day, but you're not mad at me. You just want to hang out. And I think it's simplistic, but in that good way where people can be complicated and that can bring about, you know, yeah, hardship or just, you know, compromise a lot. And animals in their simplicity even if it allows you to project things that aren't true, maybe aren't true, still serves that sort of, I always know my dog will love me no matter what. You know, I had a bad day, but I've got my dog.
And that's a good thing, you think?
I think it's, like many things, it's a good thing if we don't take it too far. Because the more romantic you get about what you think your dog is thinking, the more you're liable to have it really affect your decisions on how you treat them or what you give them. And that can absolutely turn to become something that does not benefit the dog. If you really think this romantic idea about your dog is true, then you'll treat them in a way that doesn't respect their animal nature. And that's not good for them. It might be good for you. I don't know. But it's very often not good for dogs to be not seen as exactly who they are.
That's psychologist and dog trainer Amy Cook speaking with you.
Hello, I'm Chris Hoff.
And in case you forgot, I'm Martina Castro. So, Chris, I could have sworn I saw Amy Cook come in with her dog to her interview.
Yeah, Marzipan was really well-behaved, just sat there the whole time we did the interview.
Did that annoy you?
Well, not really.
That's really funny because, you know, dogs being everywhere is something that people who like dogs might not mind, but if you don't like dogs, it can drive you crazy.
And that's what Farhad Manju feels. You can tell because he wrote an article for Slate magazine called "No, I Do Not Want to Pet Your Dog." KALW's Liz Pfeffer sat down with him and let him vent.
I'm not a big fan of dogs. I guess I'm just sort of not a dog person. And I think that in public, lots of public places and even private places like, you know, businesses and libraries and pretty much sort of everywhere you go in cities, dogs are everywhere and their owners sort of expect you to interact with the dogs. They kind of assume that everybody just wants to like pet their dogs and be friendly with their dogs. And I find it annoying, and I know other people are allergic to dogs and scared of dogs. And I think that there's just this general, it seems as if there's a general presumption on the part of dog owners that everybody ought to love dogs. I have the same feeling about dogs as I do about my 2-year-old, which is like, I find my 2-year-old like the best person in the world. But he does things that aren't allowed in polite society. He'll yell at people. He'll like, you know, he has a tendency as a 2-year-old to like be loud and be inappropriate and do lots of things that most other people don't find as adorable as I do. And so then when we're in public places, I try to rein him in and make sure that like he doesn't say inappropriate things or is too loud. And I think that many people don't control their dogs the same way. I think that when dogs are in public, in places where they can interact with other people, they should be controlled in much the same way that we try to control our young children as a society. Like, you don't let young children kind of run free in many places. Like, you discipline them. And I think that there can be places in cities where you can let dogs run off leash, and those are specified places. But in most places, like, dogs should be controlled by their owners. And you don't really see that happening. And I don't think you should have dogs in restaurants and in places where there are like, you know, potential health violations or just lots of people who are in a confined space who might not like your dog. In response to my article, I heard actually from many dog owners who agreed with me, who thought, you know, kind of bad dog owners were giving most dog owners a bad name. Like, I was actually like very surprised because I thought that most people who have dogs would like reflexively criticize the story and sort of not really see the point I was making. And I was gratified that many people saw it my way. And there were also a bunch of people who, you know, don't have dogs who felt that I was speaking out for them because they feel the same way about dogs, but they're not allowed to say so. Like, it's just like the thing that I stated in my article is not like an unusual point of view. It's just not often stated that people, like, everybody doesn't like dogs. I think people are afraid of saying that they might not like dogs.
That's Farhad Manju. He spoke with KALW's Liz Pfeffer. like he says, Martina, this whole debate kind of boils down to responsible dog ownership.
And that came up at the dog show, too. Legend Gene Bobbitt summed it up well.
So, take care of your dog like you would your kids and yourself and your husband. Throw him in, too.
And just have a good life with your dog, she says. Because a dog's life is pretty short. Not too long ago, when Bobbitt's own dog was sick, she knew she'd have to put it down.
Twice I made the appointment, and twice I canceled it, because I said, she's not ready. The third morning I woke up, and I patted her, and I felt this great big tumor on the side of her head under her ear. And it was as though she said, I'm ready. And I went in, and I held her in my arms, and she went to sleep. And I felt terrible. And I have to admit, I did not cry when I went home. I never do. I went home, I cleaned crates, I washed bedding, I cleaned the house. I worked myself till I had to go to bed that night. And about 2 weeks later, I cried. Because then it really hit me. My house was quiet. There was no dog in it.
Whatever you might think about dogs, it does seem that there's a special connection that we humans have with them. As Amy Cook said, they fill this physiological need. They can make us feel better. And that's real.
But maybe it's how each of us chooses to deal with that connection that is such a mixed bag. I mean, some of us exploit it and make a lot of money off of it, both in responsible and irresponsible ways.
And there are consequences to those choices for all of us. Because face it, we live in a city. It's a dense urban environment. So we're really up in each other's business, literally.
Well, that's not totally literal. But not everybody wants to pick up dog poop, I can tell you that. Or take their dog with them everywhere they go, or even interact with dogs at all. It's kind of like Farhad said, my owning a dog directly affects you.
And there are so many dogs now that we need to figure out how to integrate them into our society in a way that works for everyone.
Hmm. I wonder what Gene Bobbitt would say about all this.
I think we've had enough of this dog conversation.
Yeah, she's probably right. Wait.
We are not ending the dog show with that song.
That's what I'm talking about.
For Cross Currents, I'm Martina Castro.
And I'm Chris Hoff.